Today's Monday, June 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Last year, some 82.4 million people had been displaced.
It's the highest number on record and comes even with COVID-19 restrictions on movement and border closures.
Plus, what's at stake as Ethiopia heads to the polls?
Whether the election is able to usher in a period of greater stability, or is the election likely to a further polarization?
We'll have these stories and more next. Sunday was World Refugee Day. The United Nations reports that by the end of 2020, the number of people around the world who had been forcibly displaced from their homes totaled 82.4 million. That's the highest number on record. VOA's Laurel Bowman starts us off.
I'm very happy to see you.
The smiles. The songs. The prayers. The kicks.
Playing soccer makes me feel really, really happy and really social.
These are some of the 82.4 million people the UN reports has displaced in 2020 by persecution, human rights violations, and events seriously disturbing public order. It's the highest number on record and comes even with COVID-19 restrictions on movement and border closures.
And what is really quite shocking is that over the last 10 years, the numbers of people who are refugees or forcibly displaced has more than doubled. Something like 48% are children and youths. So we really have generations of children who are separated from their countries of origin.
The UN reports that overall, one in 95 people is now forcibly displaced, including more than half the population of Syria, both inside the country and out. Syrians represent the largest group of those displaced internationally, and experts say their needs are many.
I want to tell you about even education. You cannot just put education alone. You need to put education with mental health, for instance, together, because we have a lot of traumatized Syrian refugees, and they cannot comprehend. So you need to work on the mental health, like psychosocial support, plus education.
Venezuelans represent the second largest group of forcibly displaced people. Many have fled to neighboring Colombia. And displacement from Central America is up 50-fold over the last 10 years, with many refugees heading north to the United States.
And I think it's really important to think about refugees not just as a burden on society, but to think about them as consumers and contributors, because they actually add to economic growth. They add to economic development.
The number of unaccompanied children in 2020 was disproportionately high, according to the UN report. And climate change further drove migration and increased instability among those already on the move.
The need for resources, water, land, ability to feed herds and to grow crops, these are all affected by climate change. And they lead to conflict. And conflict leads to displacement.
The UN report showed that 86% of people displaced across borders are hosted by developing countries. Laurel Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
On this World Refugee Day, the Voice of America released a special 96-minute documentary called A Day in the Life of Refugees. It brought together more than 100 contributors and stories from over 30 countries. The entire film is available to stream for free at voanews.com/refugees and will also be shown in other markets as well. Here's a little taste of one of the largest reporting projects in VOA's 80-year history.
It's 0 hours of the 20th of June.
It's 2019. Maritime police from Frontex, the European Border and Coast Guard Agency, will search for refugees trying to cross from Turkey into Greece. This year, more than 50 people have died trying to cross, two this month. At the same time, it is early morning in Indonesia. Attendees at morning prayers will include Afghans who fled here. They thought they would be safe once in the world's largest Muslim country. The reality is different. In the United States, volunteers will wait near a border overwhelmed by migrants who are willing to risk it all.
Everything you have ever had, everyone you have ever known, and flee to a country that you know is in all likelihood going to be hostile to you. But that's your only choice.
Around the world, dignitaries and refugees will mark World Refugee Day, a single day representing a worldwide crisis that on this day seems to be only getting worse. These are just a few of the more than 70 million stories that can be told this day. On this single day, Voice of America sends more than 75 photojournalists to tell those stories. June 20th, 2019. It is World Refugee Day, the last World Refugee Day before the COVID pandemic.
It's important that people are aware it's everyone's problem.
A day like any other day in the life of refugees.
As the United Nations recognizes World Refugee Day, families in the Tigray region of Ethiopia continue to be forced to flee war, often only to be displaced again by violence or the massive social and economic strain caused by the crises. VOA's Heather Murdoch has that part of the story.
At this camp in the Tigray region of Ethiopia, families pack up their things swiftly. But it isn't much. Most of their belongings were left behind when they fled the war. Soldiers here say the university campus where these families are being hosted needs to open and people have to leave immediately. Vehicles that locals call bajajas line up to transport people and goods at cheap prices as another camp is set up across town.
They told us we have to leave a month ago, and since then they have come every few days. The only difference is now they are using force.
UN officials briefly visit, saying the new camp is not ready and the move is unjust. But they quickly concede to local forces and tell people to follow the soldiers' orders. Worldwide, an estimated more than 80 million people are displaced from their homes, forced to flee war or persecution. Nearly 60% remain in their home countries, sometimes forced to flee the same conflict over and over again. In Tigray, many displaced families were split up in the chaos, with about 2 million people fleeing within Ethiopia and more than 60,000 people crossing the border to take refuge in Sudan.
So many people fled to Sudan, but I was pregnant and couldn't get that far.
After she fled, she says, her husband was arrested and her cattle confiscated. She says she cannot imagine raising four children in the camp, but she also does not think it will ever be safe to go home. The war in Tigray began last November when the Tigray People's Liberation Front attacked northern federal bases and the Ethiopian National Defense Force swept through the region. Eritrean forces are fighting with the federal government, and both sides also have associated militias. Civilians in Tigray have reported widespread looting, beatings, mass killings, and rapes. Much of the region is in danger of famine, which is already occurring in some places. And on top of these horrors, the economy has been crushed. Cities are packed with displaced families, while farms go untended and food is not grown.
I was a farmer with good land, and I grew sorghum, but I was displaced just before the harvest and arrived here with nothing.
The global population of forcibly displaced people has more than doubled in the past decade. And in Tigray, locals say numbers keep growing. On Monday, Ethiopians in most of the country will go to the polls for the first national election in 6 years. But in Tigray, there will be no voting, only praying for relief after nearly 8 months of war. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Shira, Ethiopia.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. On Monday, Ethiopia holds its twice-delayed national elections. The stakes are significant in a country enmeshed in a brutal conflict in its Tigray region and seeing a surge in regional and ethnic violence. For an overview of the election and its implications, VOA's Kate Pound Dawson spoke with Terrence Lyons, a professor of peace and conflict studies at George Mason University near Washington. He has studied and written extensively about Ethiopia's legacy of conflict.
Ethiopia has been in a transitional process since 2018, and the prospects for democracy and stability seemed quite promising at the beginning. More recently, however, Ethiopia is seeing significant conflict, not only in Tigray, the northernmost region, but also in parts of the Oromo region, parts of the Amhara and the Benishangul-Gumuz region. And so whether the election is able to usher in a period of greater stability, or is the election likely to further polarization, fragmentation, and divisions, I think that's what's at stake. I think the who's going to win and so forth is clearer than will the post-electoral period provide the opportunities that Ethiopians need in order to build more a stable democratic society.
What are the expectations about whether this election can be free and fair and reasonably peaceful?
Well, I mean, on the question of peaceful, there's already a significant amount of violence. I'm not sure the election per se will spark a new round of electoral violence, in part because there is so much underlying violence. I'm afraid that in most of Ethiopia, the election will not be competitive. In Tigray, the election has been canceled because of the war. In the Oromo region, which is the largest, most populous region, most of the historical opposition parties are boycotting. Many of the constituencies or the ruling party is running unopposed. There is some competition in the Amhara region, and it'd be interesting to watch that. The politics in the south and in some of the regions like the Somali and the Afar region are often very, you know, local. It's a question of which local constituency will gain access to power and hence a greater resource. So I think the real regions to watch are the Amhara region, to see if some of the opposition parties are able to get significant seats. And then second of all, to look at questions like turnout, levels of registration, to get an idea of is the prosperity party, the ruling party, a party that can mobilize at the grassroots, can get its people to the polls, can operate as a political institution connected at the grassroots.
Now, Ethiopia, of course, is a major player in regional developments. What are the implications for this election for Ethiopia's neighbors?
The way that I put it is that in Ethiopia, regional politics are also local politics. So what happens in Mogadishu in Somalia has implications for the Somali region of Ethiopia. The populations across the border between Ethiopia and South Sudan and Ethiopia and Sudan mean that there's often those links can often exacerbate or spark conflict. The biggest conflict right now is with Eritrea. Eritrean troops are deeply involved in the war in Tigray, and that is makes any prospects for peace in Tigray extremely difficult. It'll be difficult to get the Eritreans to withdraw. The Ethiopian government says they expect the Eritreans to withdraw, but that suggests that the Eritreans will decide when they wish to withdraw. More broadly, if Ethiopia were to move into a period of greater instability, that would then spread across the region. The instability in Ethiopia would inevitably shape political prospects in Somalia, in Eritrea, and all the other neighboring countries. And so the entire region, and therefore, frankly, the entire world, has a real stake in Ethiopia's stability and the prospects for a more democratic, less authoritarian Ethiopia.
That was George Mason University Professor Terrence Lyons speaking with my colleague, Kate Pound-Dawson. A government official says that 48% of Iran's 59 million eligible voters cast ballots in last Friday's presidential election, of which 17 million were reportedly cast for Judiciary Chief Ibrahim Raisi, an ally of the country's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. Regional governments reacted with little surprise to Raisi's victory, and it is unclear that the winner will be able to improve relations with Iran's Arab neighbors when he takes office in August. Edward Uranian takes it from here.
Iran's Interior Minister Abdulrida Rahmani Fazli declared Judiciary Chief Ibrahim Raisi the winner of Friday's presidential election, carrying 17 million of the 28 million votes that were cast by the country's 59 million eligible voters. Raisi, a close ally of Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, is due to take office in August. A number of Iranian political leaders had called on the Iranian people to boycott the election, among them former hardline President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and People's Mujahideen leader Miriam Rajavi. Official turnout was under 50% of eligible voters, while 8 to 10% of ballots cast were void. Former Iranian diplomat Mirdad Khansari told VOA that the vote was a clear disavowal by the Iranian public of Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei and of the deep state apparatus that runs the country.
This is a positive development in the sense that it places the deep state squarely in front of the people. Khamenei and his cronies no longer have any contractors to present a different face of the true nature of their regime to the outside world and to the Iranian people.
Khansari stressed that Iran's moderate reform movement, which reportedly won 2009's presidential election before the government backtracked on the results, was also repudiated by voters. The election, he says, showed the lack of confidence the public had in any remnants of the reform movement who were not able to get their act straight or act in a cohesive manner to stand with the majority of Iranians to boycott the election. Former Iranian President Abul Hassan Bani Sadr, who lives in exile in Paris, said in a statement that the vote consecrated the imposition of a president on the Iranian people, whom he insisted refused to accept it. The Iranian people, with their collective conscience, he argued, refused to accept the imposition of a man known by history as a murderer. Amnesty International also castigated Raisi for his alleged role in death squads that killed innocent civilians during the country's 2019 protests, as well as for killings that reportedly took place during the late 1980s. Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei claimed in a statement issued Saturday that the Iranian people were the winners of Friday's presidential election and that nothing stopped them from going out to vote. Outgoing President Hassan Rouhani, who was ineligible to run for a third term, congratulated the Iranian people for their choice of the man whom he said clearly won the election, although his official congratulations, he added, will come later. Kuwaiti analyst Mohammed Dawsari told Arab media that Iran represents a threat to the security of Gulf states, and it understands that, adding that Tehran needs to make some concessions over Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, and Yemen before any possible rapprochement. Arab states made little apparent effort to congratulate Raisi for winning the election, other than Iraq and Syria, which have close ties to Tehran. The prime minister of neighboring Pakistan, Imran Khan, also congratulated Raisi, as did Russian President Vladimir Putin, who enjoys close ties to Tehran. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan on Sunday downplayed the importance of the election, which named Raisi as the new Iranian president. He said that whether the United States ultimately rejoins the 2015 Iran nuclear deal will depend on decisions made by the country's supreme leader. Negotiators for Iran and the other six countries had been meeting, but adjourned on Sunday to return to their respective capitals for further consultations on difficult remaining considerations. Iran's top negotiator, Abbas Araghchi, explained.
We are closer to a deal than any time in the past, but it doesn't mean that we are there. The remaining job is still difficult and needs lots of, you know, efforts and you know, further talks.
It remains unclear when formal international negotiations may resume. A relative of King Abdullah II and a former royal court chief are set to take the stand in Jordan's upcoming trial of the century. AP correspondent Karen Chamas has the details.
The two men are to be ushered into the defendant's cage at the State Security Court to face charges of sedition and incitement. They're accused of conspiring with the king's half-brother, Prince Hamza, to foment unrest against the monarch whilst asking for foreign help. What may have been seen as a family matter erupted into the public domain when Hamza was placed under house arrest. The move sent jitters through Jordan and foreign capitals, with Western powers rallying behind the king, who's considered an ally in an otherwise unstable region. Former Information Minister Mohammed Al-Momami says a split in the family has repercussions for the whole country.
It's unity and solidarity. It's much linked also to the stability of the country.
I'm Karen Chamas.
This is Science in a Minute.
Everyone occasionally gets the hiccups. Dr. Ali Saifi, MD, from the University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio, says in a press release that for those suffering from a brain or stroke injury or cancer, getting an episode of the hiccups can be quite serious and can severely affect their quality of life. Dr. Saifi and his team of colleagues studied the effectiveness of a device he developed to stop hiccups. Called a forced inspiratory suction and swallow tool, or FIST, the device is a stiff drinking tube equipped with an inlet valve that forces the patient to use strong suction to draw water from a cup and into the mouth. Details of the team's research can be found in a new study published in the journal JAMA Network Open. The study suggests that the device stopped hiccups in nearly 92% of the cases as reported by users. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Countries accused of abusing their people's human rights will come under the lens of the UN Human Rights Council over the next 3 weeks. Dozens of thematic issues and country reports on topics including the COVID-19 pandemic will be addressed during the session, which begins on Monday. Lisa Schlein is up next.
The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, will present an oral update on the human rights crisis unfolding in Myanmar since the military coup there on February 1st. Her report is likely to reflect condemnation of the military leader's violent crackdown on the civilian population and what she sees as a looming threat of civil war in the country. The Council also will hear updates on the human rights situation in other countries, including Eritrea, Iran, Nicaragua, South Sudan, and Syria. Separately, observers view events in northern Ethiopia's Tigray region as one of the most serious human rights issues around. The executive director of Human Rights Watch, Kenneth Roth, says reports of imminent famine, summary executions, rape, and other atrocities perpetrated in Tigray warrant action by the Human Rights Council. He is calling for the adoption of a resolution condemning these practices at this session.
A resolution should clearly name the governments. So, you know, we know that Ethiopian government forces have been major perpetrators of these crimes, along with, as you mentioned, the Eritrean forces, which is important to recognize. You know, the Eritrean forces didn't invade Tigray. They were invited in by the Ethiopian government.
Violence erupted in Tigray in November when forces of the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front attacked federal military bases in the region. The Ethiopian government responded with the use of military force. High Commissioner Bachelet also will present a report on police violence and systemic racism against people of African descent. The death of African-American George Floyd while in police custody in the United States last year triggered a special counsel session 1 year ago. Roth says he believes the report should have a strong focus on the United States. He adds, however, that systemic racism is a global problem and should be treated as such.
Our concern is really that the Human Rights Council creates some kind of mechanism to continue this. So it's not just a one-off report. But there is a more systematic effort to address root causes and to push for accountability. I don't say that at all to try to minimize the situation in the U.S. The U.S. should be a critical focus of those efforts.
The Council's last session in February focused on efforts to combat COVID-19-related violations. Bachelet will present a report on how states are responding to the pandemic. COVID-19 also will feature as a sub-theme into reports and panel discussions this session. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Australia is asking the World Trade Organization to intervene in its dispute with China over the imposition of anti-dumping duties on Australian wine exports. Phil Mercer has those details.
Relations between Australia and China, its biggest trading partner, are at their worst in decades. There's been diplomatic friction over regional geopolitical flashpoints, including Beijing's growing military ambitions in the South China Sea. Tensions escalated last year when Australia demanded an inquiry into the origins of the new coronavirus, which was first detected in China in late 2019. It was a move that infuriated Beijing, where it was interpreted as criticism of its handling of the pandemic. Since then, China has imposed tough economic sanctions on a range of Australian commodities. Beijing accused Australia of illegally subsidising its wine producers and in November announced additional import taxes of more than 200% on Australian wine for 5 years. China was Australia's most valuable wine export market, but the duties have almost killed off that lucrative trade. Australian officials have denied the wine industry has been subsidised, as China has alleged. Australia's ambassador in Beijing said China's campaign of economic punishment against his country was vindictive. Prime Minister Scott Morrison also warned that his government would respond to economic coercion. Canberra has said it will now appeal China's tariffs on wine exports to the World Trade Organization. Australian Trade Minister Dan Tehan.
In March this year, the Chinese government put countervailing duties on Australian wine ranging between 116% to 220%. That has had a serious impact on the Australian wine industry. Our exports have fallen from $1.1 billion to approximately $20 million. As a result, and following close consultation with the Australian wine industry, and I thank them for the cooperative way they've worked with the government, we've decided to take this wine dispute to the World Trade Organisation.
The action came just days after a summit of the G7 grouping of advanced economies echoed Australia's call for a tougher stand against China's trade practices. It's the second time in 6 months Canberra has called in the WTO. The first was after China applied tariffs to Australian barley exports. The WTO resolution process involves lengthy consultations and possible adjudication. Analysts warn that the WTO is unlikely to reach a conclusion regarding the contentious wine tariffs for some years. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And that's going to do it for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other electronic device to voanews.com. And don't forget, our VOA A Day in the Life of Refugees documentary can be found at voanews.com/refugees. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.